Hey folks, welcome to another episode of Long Shots, and this is Nikhil Arora. I have a very smiling Mr. Sharad Tupran. How's it going, man?
You don't need me for that question.
Yeah, no, I need to ask that question, and I also need to give a verbatim description of your face while doing that.
Can't complain.
No traffic woes, no weather woes.
No, it's good. Life is good. Can't complain. Everything is good.
You know why I do that, right? Every time I ask you this question to get some creativity juices flowing out. But seems like we'll have to wait for the next episode
We'll have to. Yeah. Creativity is in short supply. Yeah. But talking about creativity, we have a fairly interesting guest today.
Yes, absolutely. We have Mr. Ankit Agarwal with us. And before we go into a bit more detail about his profile, Ankit, I think, kind of sits on a nice crux between content and marketing. So I'm sure there are lots of common things here to talk about. I'm certain that we'll touch various sectors, be it food tech, be it content, be it OTT. So Sharad is going to get excited when that happens. And thank you so much, Ankit. Thanks for being here. And before we go in a bit further, standard house rules, do subscribe to our podcast. Search for Transfront Podcasts on Apple, Google, Spotify, so that you get that nice little notification every time an episode goes live. So my part is done for now. And thank you so much for coming over, Ankit. How's it going?
It's good, man. Thanks. Pleasure to be here and talking to you guys.
So Ankit, in terms of, as all our listeners know, we are stickler for research. So we have opened your LinkedIn profile. I think that will be a good way to go through what you have been doing. And it seems that obviously you worked in very funky sounding things. You know, you worked on performance marketing. I have no idea what that is. And you also were associated with Uber for some time. You have your own personal finance blog,
yes,
which has over 2,000 subs. 80% revenue growth year on year. That's your LinkedIn stats. I don't know how updated they are.
Fairly old, but
yeah, but we can roll with that. Tell me what really drives you on a day-to-day basis.
I think just a little bit of background, right? Like a typical engineer, did my MBA from Canada, and I think started out in technology. And while technology always sort of remained something I was always curious in, I think 2008-9 is when I sort of explored the world of blogging, right? And that's when I started getting my first paycheck, and it was sort of exciting to sort of journal whatever I was doing, right? I think the blog started just as a hobby to capture that, but I think I got sort of consumed by this world of digital in terms of how sort of digital started becoming that equalizer, right? Where you didn't have to sort of be knowledgeable or a subject matter expert to have a voice or an opinion, right?
So just to give some context, your blog's name is Getting Money Wise.
Getting Money Wise.
So that started in August 2008, right when the crisis hit. So, well done.
Yeah, the timing matched, right?
Yeah.
I think I got into it as a pure hobby because the work was sort of not anything to do with any cool stuff, right? I used to do ERP consulting for large manufacturing clients, which is
very different from
like how the consumer world worked, right?
Right.
So I think that sort of was a genesis of me sort of trying and enjoying the world of digital.
Right.
And post MBA, I think I made a call that I think, and this was almost like 2013, right? 2013-14. Mm-hmm. And digital already had gone mainstream, right? And I think the interest then just grew, and I said, I want to build a career in digital.
Right.
So that sort of was the genesis of starting my career in digital and performance marketing that will come to.
But the interesting thing is that you picked personal finance, right? Through your platform, which is again a very, very, I would say, precise and somewhat non-accessible area.
Yeah, exactly, right? And I think also at that point it was full of like information asymmetry because of jargons and how complex personal finance is made out to be.
Right.
So I think it was for my attempt to say, okay, let me demystify it the way I am approaching it, right? Not to teach people, but just for myself.
Right.
And I think that personal finance seemed like the thing, right? Because it was like I started investing, so it kind of made sense then.
How were your subscribers discovering you? And sort of how were you trying to monetize it as well, or was it not the primary motive at that time?
No, so I think when it started, the monetization was not sort of an outcome I was looking for, right? But I think once you start learning and understanding what people are doing with blogs, I think you get sucked into that vortex of saying everybody's monetizing, right? And even though blogging was not as big then, you still have a lot of people who were just making money by telling people how to make money, right?
Right.
So you get sucked into that. So I've had my phases wherein I said, okay, let's monetize. But then again, I mean, at like it was not a critical mass for me to sort of build it, right? Like in
right.
terms of real revenue.
Right.
So I then got back and saying, okay, no more monetization focus. Let's just keep creating content.
Right.
And I think that bode well, right? Because at that time, if you write not for the search engine, but for the human, I think there is merit in sort of just picking up organic subscription, right? Where people
right.
come in and they would come because I would post it on social. It was pure organic, right? Like
yeah.
at that point, I would just write, and I was fairly active on Twitter and Facebook as well.
Yeah.
Right.
So the initial sort of 500, 600 subscribers sort of just happened through there. And then post that, I think with SEO also just picked up some skills, but
right.
also age also matters, right? So
right.
my blog was 2.5 years old.
Right.
And then some of the content started getting picked up organically from search.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Because I was also doing sort of very definition type of content, right? Like what is a green shoe? What is a PLSS?
Right.
Right. And like the only advantage now in hindsight was I was writing it like a human
right.
versus how the industry wrote it, which was sort of with a ton of stars and a lot of complicated
right.
stuff. So I basically decodified it the way how I approached it, right? So
right.
I think that resonated well.
Were you doing SEO optimization stuff as well, or that was
yeah, so I mean, I think it was
organically.
Organically, but I was also like, once you start learning about the industry, right? And
yeah.
that's where the passion grew. Like it started as a content outlet, but it started becoming like a passion point in terms of saying, let me understand this world of digital and distribution and content.
Yeah.
Right. So I think that sort of led me to spending some time over weekends understanding what SEO is.
Right.
At that point, communities were big, right? So you
right.
would have these personal finance communities
yes.
where you could go engage in.
Yeah.
So started participating in those as well.
Right.
So yeah, so that was pretty much the story there.
So there was a bit of overlap in terms of, I guess, your B-School as well, right? So you started the blog, then you also went to B-School in between.
Yeah, yeah, so I think 2012, like four and a half years of, right. after working in IT, I sort of said, okay, what next? And decided to go to my B-School in Canada. And the funny thing is, right, like you never expect it, but I think that time, I mean, if you're a student in a foreign university, it's not cheap to sort of make do, right? And I think
right.
the blog sort of paved the way then.
Okay.
And like, never thought it would work like that, but
right.
like I was glad that I didn't have to do those typical sort of student jobs that you do, which is like a teaching assistant or a research
right, right.
assistant,
right, right,
because
right.
I could sit at home for two
right.
hours and actually know that I would like sit and get better ROI on that.
Right.
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 So I think like the blog really helped and
right.
also allowed me to pivot to sort of US centric content, which I think now again in hindsight was beautiful, because in India, the CPMs or what they call like the media cost that you get,
yeah.
media revenue
right.
was significantly lower.
Right.
Right. One just country, but I also like even the personal finance is one of the highest monetized category from what advertisers are ready to pay. The difference between India and US rates was just so stark.
Right.
And that I think was like a pure calculated move at that point in terms of started talking about stuff like refinancing, mortgage, debt, because that's sort of, these are the topics that are very, very big in like sort of the Western world.
And you continue to like do more and more explanatory style content on the...
To be honest, I mean, I think at that point, I did not understand the Western market or the Western terminology as much.
Right.
So then I did sort of hire a bunch of freelancers to
right.
create some content because
right.
they would understand. But I think the underlying focus always was that it is a personal finance blog from a next door guy, right? If
right.
I take that analogy.
Right.
Which is saying like, I will give it to you. I will not give you all the information or everything right. But
yeah.
at least the focus always on the writing was saying we have to make it very, very sort of, I don't know if I can use the poop, but dumb proof, right? Like
right.
just get it in terms
right.
of a language people can understand.
And in terms of sort of monetization, was it like advertising or like affiliate or a mix of both, or how was that?
Yeah, so I think it was multifold, right? I think the world of blogging also has changed.
Yeah.
But I think for me, the three biggest contributors were pure advertising, which is banner advertising.
Yeah.
Affiliates was on and off, but I think there was a point it became a very, very huge source of revenue.
Okay.
And I think the third piece that sort of now gets considered a little bit black hat or not something Google likes, which is basically sort of sponsored posts.
Right.
Which is essentially like any client or an agency wants to write a piece of content, have their website linked to it, right? And I think that sort of was fairly big.
Right.
But again, right now in hindsight, I think that was slightly short-termist, because
right.
I think Google now has gotten really, really strict about monetizing your blog via sponsored content.
Right.
So, but yeah, I mean, affiliate at one point worked really, really well. Like, I mean, credit card leads and like
yeah.
sales, you would get a lot of money. And like, technically, you don't have to work on it, right? Like, if just the banner exists on the website, anybody can go.
Right.
So I think that was fairly big.
Do you see a big difference in the affiliate marketplace in the West and in India?
I think it is, right? I think some of it is just how the market will evolve, right? Mm. The other piece also is, I think, some of the infrastructure. Right. Like in the West, I think they have experimented, perfected it over time in terms of what advertisers are willing to give.
Yeah.
Right. So they have a better sense of ROI. And the other thing also is anytime something new happens, like India will take time, right? There are enough bad actors in the system who sort of try and game the affiliate system, right? Mm. Like there are tough technical terms like cookie bombing, wherein like they get a click, but like even if after 180 days you buy, you still get the affiliate commissions, right?
Water.
Which is, so I think it is challenging and slightly different, but it's also because like I think India is much more regulated in terms of what all could you push out, right?
Right.
Like for example, in the US you could do a lot of sort of short term loans, a lot of
Before you kind of go into that, just for the benefit of listeners, I think we need to kind of also deconstruct what affiliate is. Like I think room get it.
Yeah.
But and there are two questions actually kind of which follow up from there. One is obviously that you picked personal finance, and then when you look at affiliate, there is always that the oldest argument comes that okay, if you are kind of explaining something to me, or if you are quote unquote recommending a personal finance product to me, you're also getting leads for manufacturers.
Right.
I mean, how do you maintain that quote unquote independence or verifiability? How did you go across that? I'm pretty sure guys must be often commenting on your posts that, I think that typically
conflict
happens.
Yes.
But before that, maybe we can just do a short, explain it.
I think affiliate marketing in its like simplest form is if you have something to sell, right? Like it could be any product, and then there is somebody who could distribute it, right?
Right.
So for example, if I'm a blogger or a publisher, an advertiser says, I want to sell something, but I don't want to pay you just for visibility, right? As an advertiser, I'm saying, how do I reduce my risk of spending this marketing dollar?
Right.
So the way affiliate essentially translates is the contract between an advertiser and a distributor is essentially saying, an advertiser say, I'll pay you X.
Mm.
If Y happens, which is, for example, they will say, I'll give you $20 for every time somebody clicks or somebody buys my product from your website, right? So that is like in its purest form. Now it can be fairly complex in terms of you could do it very tiered, where you're saying for every 100 people you bring me, I'll give you 20%. But if you bring me 200 people, I'll give you 25%.
Right.
Like the logistics of how that relationship works can be...
But I guess the transaction doesn't happen on the distributor's platform, does it?
No. It's just basically linking, right? So you can
track. Lead generation.
So you become the redirect essentially.
Right.
And they can measure saying how many people came from this platform versus the other platform.
And I guess in the US, I mean, one of the things that you were probably pointing to earlier was that there are lots of structured affiliate programs which are out there, right? Which probably here, barring a few categories,
like Amazon has one here.
It's not really visible.
Yeah,
Do you see that changing slowly? Because I was reading somewhere like it's like almost 15% of e-commerce sales actually in India has happened through affiliate.
Yeah.
So who's running the show here?
There are a lot of there are two pieces of affiliate, right? So one is essentially like the likes of Amazon and Flipkart have they launched their own programs, right?
Got it.
Which is saying they control it,
right?
And you only like become an affiliate for Flipkart,
right?
Right. So that is, I think, a better way of doing it, because then you can control the experience, you can control the infra,
right?
I think there's this other piece where there would be 5,000 independent sort of companies,
right,
that say that we will do this for you, right? So you say, give us 5,000 rupees per transaction or whatever, and we will figure it out.
Right.
I think that is the part that is sort of the disorganized part is where a lot of sort of fraud also exists in the system.
Right.
Because I think like India by design, hyper-competitive and all that.
Right.
So I think just from a technical infra, but also just like a mindset, I think that part is not as evolved as it is in the US. Right.
Well, when I first met you, I think it was 2013 or 2012, I remember you were... deeply invested in understanding, analyzing, and maybe even trading digital ad spots. Online advertising. What was that like?
Perfect position to talk to you guys, right? Yeah. Like, I think the easiest explanation of how the digital advertising, and we'll get into it a little more detail, but it is like how stock trading happens, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's a buyer, there's a seller, and there's a need base, right? Like, if demand is high, then you get better rates versus if supply is too high, then like, so that's pretty much like the way stock market function is in simplest form how digital advertising works, wherein like there's a publisher and there's an advertiser, right?
Mm-hmm.
And these two basically talking, and it's negotiating on saying, so while a stock is saying how many units are you buying,
right,
in the ad ecosystem it's saying how many impressions you're buying, right? Which is saying how many times should my ad show,
right?
And I sort of build pricing around that.
And then taking the analogy from the stock market, in stocks you can look at like a technical analysis, you know, the fundamentals, and basically are trying to find undervalued opportunities, right? I mean, in this particular space, how do you go about that?
There are a lot of factors, right? So I think one, just pure traffic, right?
Right.
And there are enough third-party sources like Alexa, or as an advertiser, I can ask you to share your Google Analytics, which is your internal analytics, right? So traffic becomes the easiest one. We're saying, do you even have traffic?
Right.
So I think that is one. Right. Social proof is a big one.
Right.
Where you say, like, does your blog have 50,000 followers on Twitter or whatever? Because
right.
I think as an advertiser, the first and primary focus I have is, do you get me reach?
Right,
which is like, do you even have the wherewithal to actually put my like ads out there, right? And then you start getting into quality lenses, which is, for example, email subscription, right? I think is a big one, because that I think is one currency where publisher is basically signaling that there are enough people who like give me access to their inbox, so I think that becomes a much bigger factor, right? Then there are other
You have to take a forward looking view here as well, right? I mean, you're basically trying to spot those,
the real estate,
the lack of a better word, which will actually become valuable tomorrow. So, I mean, in terms of the forward-looking view, I mean, you get current data, but how do you kind of extrapolate that? Or is that something more subjective?
Yeah, I think it is subjective, right? Like, and then you also get into, right? Like, for example, for my blog, for example, right? Like, I might have a smaller sort of reader base than, let's say, a big generic blog.
Right.
But I think what I am very, very sort of suited for a lot of advertisers which have something related to personal finance.
Right.
So even though my audience could be smaller, the intent is obviously higher.
Right.
So I think that becomes a subjective trade-off, wherein I could sort of advertise on a blog that talks about everything from like buying groceries to personal finance to shopping. Then suddenly as a personal finance or as a bank, I suddenly don't look at that platform so much more intently, right? Versus like a pure personal finance platform, which I think becomes a subjective call.
And all this was all these were your own ventures and you were playing around, and that sort of led you to Havas Media, was it? And how was that? What, you know, that's an agency. So how does that sit with the entire thing?
Yeah, so I think, again, right, I was doing a lot of stuff in digital and all self-learned, right? And I think the beauty of the ecosystem was that you just had like new stuff coming every day, right? Like digital as an ecosystem was evolving. Like, I mean, this is still circa 2014, right? Like now you sit in 2019 and it has blown up in a different way, but you still had like everybody popping up. Like you had new platforms popping up, right? So I think I was so immersed and I was loving that experience. So then I thought, okay, why not do it at an institutional level, right? Like because I'd seen the publisher side, but I'd not seen the advertiser side as much, right? And I said, if this is where the industry is going, right? Like if every industry... So there's this quote, this famous investor, Mark Andreessen of Andreessen Horowitz and the founder of Netscape. I don't remember which year he said it. He said software is eating the world,
right?
Which is essentially saying everything is going to become like in some form or shape digital, right?
Right.
So I think that was a bet I took on myself after B-School to say, let's actually just immerse himself in this ecosystem on a sort of formal level, and I think I'll be honest, right, I mean this is a place to be vulnerable, right? Not a lot of clients sort of wanted to take a bet on a self-learned digital marketer who has no experience in the Canadian market, so then I think it was a lot of struggle to sort of get there, but I think ended up at an agency called Havas Media, obviously a global sort of media agency, and they were largely like, again, big clients, global clients for them, right? I think for me, that was the bet I said, where saying, yes, I have to work there. But I think that was my sort of bet on saying, okay, I will actually understand how this beast works at a different scale, at an institutional scale, right? So I think that's sort of where the journey happened.
But, you know, I mean, in terms of digital marketing itself, I mean, there are waves of so-called trends which kind of pop up, you know, people comment on that. Like, I remember there was a time when social came for the first time, it completely exploded, and, you know, everyone was kind of having a very social media oriented strategy. But then over time, that social itself became a kind of mass market play, yeah. right? And then so the ROI or the engagement probably move to more specialist social media platforms, like away from the Facebooks to like things like Instagram. And,
sure.
And now we're in an era where there is also a demarcation between online and offline. And they're like, okay, so people are suddenly discovering the value of offline,
yeah.
right, as a kind of way to really engage with your end audience. How do you kind of see this space overall in terms of, you know, it, the easiest way to kind of describe is that, you know, you keep on hearing about Facebook and Google and everyone is actually taking all the ad dollars away.
Yeah.
Right. But I'm pretty sure that's not the complete picture, right? That's a good headline.
Yeah.
And I can, even from my personal experience in Canada, I think it was 2014, we'd seen like, because I was sort of covering some media companies as well, and I'd seen there was a massive inflow of ad dollars when we spoke to other brands towards social media platforms.
Yeah.
In the subsequent year, they had all reverted, not all, but a significant piece of it reverted back towards television. There's an ongoing balancing that keeps on happening, right? But
and in the Indian context, we keep on seeing. I mean, there's a lagging
sure,
difference
yeah.
here, of course. But we keep on here, you know, seeing the dichotomy when you see like, you know, big digital brands posting front page ads on newspapers
yeah.
and paying like a crore. I mean, then you are like, okay,
these are fintech platforms, right?
Yeah. No, not just fintech platforms.
Everybody, the most
pure play platforms actually end up doing that,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
So how do you square all of that?
So I think it's a two-parter, right? I think one, the India piece will come to because I don't think it's so much the industry, but sort of how the market is.
Yeah.
But I think fundamentally, and it was the beauty of like digital as a ecosystem, right? Because there is no concept of saying, okay, we know this is what is happening, right? Like this, like a typical Gartner hype cycle, right? Something new comes in, everybody jumps on, right? Then it reaches a peak and then everybody starts doing it just for the sake of doing it, right?
Yeah.
And then sort of you see the downfall, right? Which is what you saw with social, wherein Facebook came in and said, okay, every brand needs to have a page or real estate and talk to their users there, right?
Mm-hmm.
And brands just invested a lot of dollars building content, and then suddenly you realize Facebook says, you know, guys, I need to make money.
Yeah.
So Facebook started reducing the organic reach,
right.
and then brands had to pay to reach their own user base, right? So which is like, again, right, like it's an industry wherein platforms also are very, very new, right? Like,
right.
so you can blame Facebook all you want, but I think at some point they launched it and they did whatever they thought was the best, and
right.
they had to evolve as well as a platform.
Right.
So I think one is just because the industry is as such, right, you will have new platforms come in every time, right? And I think the way it happens is a lot of smart brands or smart people experiment it when the platform is new, because there's merit in that, right? Like because the platform is new, the advertising rates are cheaper.
Yeah. yeah.
So that's how it sort of get in.
Right.
But then at the same time, there are enough platforms, which I think, I won't say for the next 5 years, but at least till date have sort of stayed very true.
Yeah.
Which is, for example, paid search or search in general, right?
Mm-hmm.
Google search and
like,
I don't think there's a trend, at least till now. Now I think we have voice that is going to change that equation. But till date, search has for the last, like whatever, till the time, since the time Google started monetizing it, like that has been fundamentally a channel that will always remain, right?
You consider it to be a more structurally robust channel versus social?
Yeah. Again, like, if you think about it, right? Like from an advertiser lens, right? At the end of the day, every marketing dollar has to give me ROI, right? Now ROI, and if you think how typical advertising happens, right? You put something out there so that people become aware, right? This is the classic marketing funnel, which is saying you want people to become aware,
right?
Which is what Facebook does a great job of, right?
Yeah.
Which is saying they will expose a new product, new brand to you.
Right.
But I think what search always has and still does is consumer intent, right?
Hmm.
So in our sort of definition, we say push versus
push
marketing.
Versus pull. Right.
So search always has remained pull as a pull marketing platform,
right?
And when you have a pull marketing platform, your ROI is going to be materially higher, right? And social, I think because it's a push platform, I think the ROI sort of tends to be slightly lower, right? And
right.
that is why you will see a lot of advertisers just move to social. And then suddenly they realize, you know, guys, the math does not add up here, right? And then I think you see that change happening, right? Then the argument on saying people going back to TV or offline, I think fundamentally, see, I think one of the beauty of digital was saying you could measure it. But I think it's also anything that gets measured, also then, like, you just want to find out too much about it, right?
Sure.
And then you started realizing that in some places, again, right, like if you had a mass product especially, right, and we'll come to the India example, but just generally if you have a mass product, like for example on a Facebook, right, like you would have every sort of demographic represented, but it would skew very heavy to, let's say, an 18 to 25.
Okay.
Now if you're a brand that wants to reach to a much bigger demographic at scale, I think offline still made sense, right? Like a TV would still make sense, because it's not that TV is not measurable, right? Like CPG has done it for ages changed now, right? Like the Cokes in the world, and they have done their math to figure it out that every time I do X amount of TV, what does that result in terms of sales, right? So right. It's not that TV and all these platforms have not not remained useful or ROI friendly. I think the promise of digital has been one saying you don't have to say the same thing to multiple people,
right?
Like, and that's the problem with TV. Once you put an ad spot on TV, that same thing goes to everyone. So I think there is, it's not an either or for me, right?
Mm.
It's essentially saying both, like offline and online, are both important.
I guess in TV also, that's not kind of changing, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
programmatic TV and the Hulu's of the world,
and all
yeah,
that, right?
They could sort of customize it for you. And that's what I'm saying, right? Like,
yeah.
And that is the beauty.
Yeah.
So whatever has worked in digital till today,
yeah.
Like you can't sit on your seat and say, okay, I know I have mastered the art of digital, right? Because tomorrow, everything will change.
Right.
Now you look at search, right? Like now voice is getting so big, voice search. Now you suddenly, as a search advertiser, you're struggling because Google, I think the last stat I saw, almost 40% of Google searches are no-click searches now.
Okay.
What it basically means is that Google's philosophy initially was they will find out what you want to find out and then take you to that link, right?
Mm.
Which is their job of saying, how do I get you out of Google as fast as possible?
Right.
But I think if you see how Google started evolving with knowledge graphs and like how they surface information... Now, for example, you ask what is Obama's age, right? Now, in the past, you would have had to click a link, go to Wikipedia, but now Google just shows it right there. Right now, imagine for somebody, search is such a big business. Now, 40% of searches are not even taking you to a page. Now, all the work you've done in SEO, you just have to rethink as to what do you do with that,
right?
Because Google just figured it out.
Right.
They won't show you. Now, same with voice. Now, if somebody's going to do voice search, all your SEO has gone for a toss, right? You can't. Like, so now, and that is what keeps me excited about the ecosystem as well, right? You can never sort of say, okay, I have learned. It just changes every day. And that's the beauty of it. And I think the last piece, I think the India piece you asked, which is saying a lot of digital first brands doing like paper, newspaper and all that. I think fundamentally for me, I don't necessarily agree. Right. And like, And
okay.
I have done it as well. I mean,
right.
As in my capacity, in my past jobs, we have also taken those calls.
Mm.
But I think that largely is also dictated by the fact that India is, at least from a startup / tech community, is seen as that 1 billion opportunity, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, the reality of it is that 1 billion is there, but now, like post-Geo world, it is happening where...
So, I mean, then it's a question of access.
Yeah, then it's a question of access,
right.
And also sometimes a fear to say, you know what, do I want to leave print?
Yeah.
Because as a marketer, like as much as we say there's enough science and measurement built out, the reality of it is like it's not there to that level, right?
Yeah.
Where like I don't think a lot of people have figured out saying, okay, what happens if I don't do print versus, right? So sometimes it's also fear, but also it's also saying just access, right? You say, acha, digital pe toh, we'll only get so many people,
right?
Even though like YouTube claims that they cover 90% of the internet user base in India, right? Which is still fairly large. But I think there is that...
I think YouTube and Facebook themselves advertise on TV once in a while.
Yeah, which is a very, very India-specific nuance, right?
Yeah,
like, Google has gone big.
Yeah.
And for two reasons, right? One, suddenly they are realizing that there's this whole new India coming online.
Right.
Right? Which is in a post-Geo world that happened.
Right.
So they are saying, how will these guys discover? So they are saying TV is still something they watch.
Right.
And they want to have that land grab saying anybody who comes onto internet. Right? Like, you also think through, right? When we guys got onto internet, it was like sort of very community-based on saying, yes, you have Facebook. We were early adopters,
right?
So I think what they are saying is we don't want to take the chance of these guys figuring it out from friends. We want to get out there say Google is what you need, Facebook is what you need.
Right.
And this is the India...
I mean, it's kind of like you have arrived kind of a setup also, right? I mean, that mind frame is pretty evident. That's why I sometimes wonder when there are like, you know, these very new green brands who no one has heard of, suddenly they'll post a front page ad, right?
Yeah. But that sort of, that doesn't surprise me at all. Like, offline advertising will never go to zero. Like, I mean, even if you, I mean, that's my view, Nikki. Even if you go for, even TVs, like dynamic ad insertion, it'll be there for like 5 years now.
Yeah.
Like, if it's a summer, it'll show you beverage ads, right? Like, they do it at IPTV level. Right,
yeah,
it's been there, but there is an offline space which has to sort of go in conjunction, right? I mean, like, I think the top advertising real estate spaces are still offline, like airports, like front pages of newspaper, right?
Mm.
So that breadth is, which is static, will always probably play a role, right? Like, how far can digital go?
So I think there are two pieces here, right? One is saying, like, you look at, like, leaf print for now, but like, let's say airport hoardings, right?
Yeah.
Now they're getting digitized, right? Like you talked about.
They're dynamic as well now,
right? So I think that one sort of digital from a underlying targeting capabilities, I think that is making a segue into how offline gets bought and delivered. I think the other piece also that is important is, I think it's also like, for example, the likes of Coke, all these brands that people love and like, they are synonymous. Mm-hmm. It took them 30, 40 years to build brands, right?
Yeah.
And whereas print and all these helped because you had almost constant recall.
Yeah.
But you look at the ecosystem today, there is just insane competition in every category, right? And the customer loyalty is gone, right? Which is one, a function of how, I mean, the so-called millennial, they're not loyal to brand, they're loyal to their needs. So in my hour of need, I don't really will say, oh, you know what, Coke is what I want. I might say, you know what, thumbs up sauces or paperboard sauces, right? So I think the value of these platforms like print and TV, because they're so cost prohibitive, right? I think that's the other lens of why TV will sort of start losing its value a little bit, because the cost, like, they have not evolved with the times, right? Like, you still look at TV pricing or TV ad spot pricing, it is just bonkers. So, like, I mean, barring the likes of like a
live sports,
I mean, live sports is just, they just go on a different trajectory altogether, right?
Yeah.
So I think one is saying, because you will also see a lot of brands getting built which are like sort of smaller businesses that are trying to get big. But I think the other piece also is, I think the notion of brand loyalty, especially in this country but also globally, is becoming very, very challenging, right?
But I mean, that's interesting, because I mean, from brand loyalty, I kind of also would extrapolate it into the business model of a lot of the new age platforms, right? In the sense that if you're like going for a mass market play where prices or discounting has become the sole differentiator,
yeah,
I mean, can you really complain if it's a, I mean, I think millennial or non-millennial, loyalty is something then suddenly becomes questionable, right?
Yeah, which is the competition game also, right?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, because nobody, the other nuance here is also nobody, no brand right now has the luxury of saying we'll grow at a sustainable way, right?
Right.
Because I think specifically in India, at least everybody's saying go 10x growth in a year, 20x growth in a year, right? And that is why you don't have the opportunity to say, okay, I will not build a price as a differentiator brand.
Right.
The other is also you saying, do I need print right now? Probably not. But if I have to grow 10x, and I mean, the winter might be coming, but at least so far the dollars have always been there, right?
Yeah.
So you don't have to be like super sort of stringent about saying, do I invest this dollar or not? Because nobody was questioning.
But do you see that changing slowly in terms of like, do you see like we are slowly going towards more of a margin sensitive framework rather than actually, you know,
or even cash flow generation?
I mean, come to think of it in terms of like, with a, obviously, like, we've gone through like, I think, one or two cycles of startup funding and busts as well. And now, right now, we are kind of in a more challenged economic environment to start with, right?
No, absolutely, right? I think
The reason why, I mean, kind of just to kind of close that point, me and Sharad have often been discussing on an earlier podcast on, we keep on hearing about the, you know, great Indian middle class, you know, the 300 million number.
Yeah.
But if you start doing the math around it, I mean, that number shrinks overnight to like a 50 or 60 million.
Absolutely.
Right. But often when you look at like the VC ecosystem, or the, you know, if you look at the showcases or ET business awards or whatever, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, that vibe still, I think, hasn't gone away. Or maybe there's a lot of too much showcasing. I don't know how much is the substance, but at least nobody's ready to talk about that.
Yeah, so I mean, like, obviously I can't quote, but like, you speak to the industry, right? Like, I think there are some smart VCs who are actually sort of now pushing their portfolio companies to actually preserve cash.
Yeah.
Because they are saying that fundraising would probably get difficult, right? And again, like, I mean, it won't apply to everyone, but I think the larger message is coming through from the VC community. But even in the advertiser community, like, I think, like, OTT as a space, right? Now, in the last 1.5 years, I think it's just gone bonkers. Which is, everybody's just saying, I have an OTT platform, install an insane amount of money burned to get downloads.
Right.
Right. But I think that winter is coming where people are realizing, you know what? What do we do with this?
Yeah.
Right? Because, like, until unless you're a Hotstar and you have, like, sports sponsorship, which allow you to sort of get advertising revenue at a markup that nobody else can. Every other platform is being looked at as saying, okay, you know what? And one, there's not a lot of incremental audiences, right? So everybody who's watching Hotstar has also a Z5 or a Woot, right? So then...
So you're mainly pointing towards a non-paywall OTT.
Yeah, and that's,
right?
Like, initially they thought, you know what, just grow the download base and then, like, something will happen.
Right.
But I think across the OTT industry, I think everybody's now saying, you know what, guys, this is fine. But we need to find a way to get them to start paying, right? Like, to subscribe, right? So I think that one, the business model itself is sort of, business model was also there, but now the shift is happening, saying, guys, you know what, just like getting people coming and watching for free and paying ad dollars is not going to cut it. So we need to really start moving the needle, get them to sort of start paying for subscription. And that has a repercussion on sort of how they deploy advertising dollars. So like, because for example, for an advertiser, if I say I'm going to spend $100, get me 30 installs, right? That will happen, because getting somebody to install and watch a little bit of content, that is fair, and you get ROI and you keep deploying that capital and it works. The moment you say I want people to pay, suddenly your marketing has to work like significantly more efficiently, and it won't happen overnight, right? Like the more you want a consumer to take the credit card and pay, you won't get the same mass, which speaks to your point and saying suddenly that 300 million starts becoming like even 30 million or 20 million, because only those people really are okay to pay. But then there's another nuance, then they have to also decide which five, like there are five platforms, so they have to then do the choice making, right? So I think it's happening in OTT, it's happening across the board, I think, but at least from a Facebook, Google, Twitter ecosystem, I think they're still their party is still on, because I think you're going through a cycle wherein every brand that has burned their hands or like have grown very fast, now they're saying, okay, let's take a step back. But then you have every like new brands mushrooming on a daily basis, right? New startups coming in, and they're flush with cash. And unfortunately, the easiest,
that has become the de facto way of
growing. So like, I think there's this fancy term in the industry called growth marketing, right? And if you go back to the roots of it, it meant very different, but I think the way it has been looked, growth is equal to performance marketing is equal to driving a lot of ad dollars into Facebook, Google, and Twitter of the world, where you can actually, they can optimize and you can get ROI faster, right? Which is not the right way. Like, growth has to be like a multifaceted approach of how you grow customer base. But right now, because everybody's flush with cash and there's this target on the back, it just become the easiest one to say, okay, let's just deploy ad dollars on digital. And get that growth fast.
And discounting, right? I mean, easiest way to gain subs is give them free money, right?
I mean, to be honest, and not because I was in that category, I think discounting is important, because I think at least in India, right? And you look at China, a lot of what we are doing is also sort of inspired by China.
Yeah.
Because in the West, all these things existed, right? So like, for example, food tech in India, the category didn't exist. Somebody had to create it.
Yeah.
Right? Uber, like, there was no category. Uber created it. And when you do category creation, right, you have to sort of get a lot of critical mass.
Sure.
Because one, people have to be okay saying, you can't be prohibitive up from the get-go, right?
Right.
The other thing is also a lot of these businesses end up being network effects, right?
Yeah.
So for example, in a case of Uber, like, you have to have demand and supply matching. So you, let's say you got a lot of supply, but if demand is not coming, then I think discounting, I know the outside-in perception is saying, oh, this is just discounting. But the reality of it is there are other nuances. So discounting sort of makes sense, right? And you can, like, there's enough sort of science and math happening to also start building those LTV projections at some point, saying even with this discounting, we can get there, right? Because there are other nuances. I mean, it's just not completely as how it looks in the outside world, right? Where saying everybody is just throwing money around.
Yeah.
I think for category creation is important. And if you look at the journey, right, like, for example, like, an Uber started with a lot of discounting. You don't see that a lot, not even like the same, like, even half the extent of the discounting, right?
Sure.
Food tech is going through the same. The Amazon, Flipkarts of the world, I mean, there is still perception saying 70% off and all that. But I think if you look and finally check out your cart, you'll realize that Quanta has started going down. But the good brands, like, still can pull that off. Like, for example, for my example is Amazon. Now, it's reached a point, Amazon and Uber have reached a point wherein even if I don't have a discount, I think that loyalty is stuck.
Right.
Which is saying now I don't care as much if I get discount or not. But I think that is only a very sort of smaller sort of pool yet, right? Like, for India at large or Bharat at large, I think price or value for money is still a very important one. So you will still sort of struggle for loyalty and say, who gives me a better sort of discount, right? So I think the nuance is slightly different. Yeah, but
I mean, I think the in case of Amazon and Uber, they had the, I mean, I guess Amazon and Uber were category creating at a global level.
Yeah.
Right, not even at the India level.
Sure.
So for them, using discounting as a customer acquisition strategy. But then you have a lot of guys who kind of piggy bank on the same model. I think that's where it starts getting crowded, and that's where the brand loyalty probably will never come, or may come after too many years or whatever, you know.
Yeah, I think the other problem is because discounting becomes this, I think as brands, I think there's a mistake also made saying nobody's also saying, okay, discounting gets me growth now, but do I have a roadmap of saying what is my product differentiation or my brand differentiation?
Because that can't be, it's the easiest to replicate as a strategy.
And that's what I said, like growth marketing, if you go back and listen to some of these guys who actually define growth marketing, right? Like Facebook sort of had a growth, they defined growth marketing, and it was never about ad advertising dollars. It was about hacking together, saying, how do I change my website? How do I expose content, right? And I'm not saying that craft is not being honed, but I think, at least in the current scenario, these things take time. They like, and nobody has the patience or the time, right? So everybody's sort of gone like...
Probably, but there is also an element of uncertainty, right? I mean, it takes time, but maybe it'll never happen.
Yeah, that's
because,
true, right?
Because the biggest problem statement is, you don't know what is the price that a consumer is willing to pay for a service, right?
Yeah.
The answer to that is, don't know right now. Maybe the price that a consumer is willing to pay, even in future, is not even sustainable. That is sort of the bearish view on all this, right?
Yeah,
that there is no data points we're accumulating on what the exact pricing power the product
has. Yeah, the other thing also is this whole notion of economies of scale, right? Where everybody is saying, okay, we will have economies
scale
of scale, but nobody is defining, okay, at what point do we say, is
exactly.
it enough?
Yeah.
Right? So you keep talking about this future state,
yeah.
and nobody knows where the future state is arriving.
Yeah.
So I think that, that is a problem.
Probably from a consumer standpoint, you know, when you're looking at the native definition of growth hacking or growth marketing, where you actually play with the UI, you make sure that the product becomes... I think that has also matured. Like, digital is now, is not new domain now, right? I mean, if you look at it from a consumer standpoint, most of the well-funded companies, their apps are good. They look nice, you know, they are... they're funky. There's no. I won't be able to like always point out that, oh, this is a better experience, right?
Yeah.
So I guess that also has a factor to play in terms of reduction in the number of levers which the company is able to pull.
Yeah, because I think like product also has gotten to a baseline.
Yeah.
And also, if you look at how some of the digital companies are today, right? They are not necessarily an skew marketplace, but you don't have a product to sell, right? I think the technology and the experience is what you're bringing together.
Right.
So I think that is fairly replicable, right? Then where you win in on like how you deliver the customer experience. I think those, you're right. Like those experiences, like for example, a Coke or a Pepsi, we can debate it, but I think product could still sort of stand out, right? Like there was a taste difference, whether marginal or not, but I think marketing was fundamentally different.
Mm-hmm.
But today, right, I think, I mean, the experience is so sort of one is saying the customer of today is evolved, right? So they don't buy into random claims that you make, right? They can well research. So they realize, like, I think everything is pretty much same.
Yeah.
So I think, it's just even more difficult to sort of like really crack the code on saying, how do we build loyalty in this?
Right.
Day and age.
Right. How do you see the ecosystem, the Indian startup ecosystem, evolve in the let's call it 10-20 years? I mean, clearly half of them won't exist, but how, like, you know, sectorally, thematically, do you think there'll be more fundamental unit economics discipline that will come in, or do you think, you know, that scale, chasing scale is something that will always happen in the startup ecosystem?
I'll honestly tell you, right, I think fundamentally, I don't think like India will lose its sheen as a scale market, right?
Okay.
Even for global sort of companies who want to come to India, but even in India, right? But I think what is really interesting that is happening is I think there's this whole divide now being built, which is saying there's an India and there's a Bharat, right? Which is an interesting way of cutting the segment by saying, do we want to build something for 300 million people? Versus do we want to build something like, I mean, everybody says we are for 3 million, but there you will see a lot of sort of companies saying, okay, let's just build for this 3%,
right,
which has disposable income, internet savvy,
right?
And but then there will be a lot of focus on the other end of the spectrum, which is saying Bharat is finally coming online, right? So far you said yes, metro would work, but like Kanpur, all these places, internet had not really blown up, right? But it's happened now.
Right.
So I think and it's already happening, right? Like you have a cred that is fundamentally saying I'm building something for the top 1%.
Right.
Which is a great from a focus perspective, because this is surprisingly also an underserved sector.
Right.
Because they're ready to pay. They don't really care about a discount, quote unquote. But they want that premium on experience.
They don't want
right?
the mass market offering.
Yeah. So and they're ready to pay a premium for that experience. But you look at anything, right? Nobody's delivering that for you.
Yeah.
So like you will see, my hypothesis, you'll see a lot of credit type companies which will say, okay, we will pick our market. The small market is fine, but we'll pick a market which give us fundamentally significantly higher margins.
And build micro-monopolies around it.
Micro-monopolies around it. And on the other end, you have a lot of companies like, there's a company, new startup called Bulbul, which is doing video commerce,
right?
Which is like a China model, but video commerce, but they're fundamentally focused on tier 2.
Vernacular,
real, like the person who talks about in the video is from that city, right? So this is, they're fundamentally saying, we don't even want to sell to a Delhi, I mean, at least for
now. It has to be local, it has to be local.
Yeah, and they're saying we're okay with a tier 2 market. Because again, right, what is happening is they're saying there is enough volume there, which is like a lot of that 300 million.
But I guess the Bharat story, the unit economics kind of becomes so-called questionable. Right?
Yeah, but then I think that is also where companies are getting built differently. Right? Okay. Like if you look at so far,
yeah,
every company says I want this also and this also.
Right.
But the realities of it, straddling both is not easy, right? Because you have to be able to like just fundamentally operationally business model. And that is the decoupling that I'm seeing, right? Like
yeah.
if you're building a company just for Bharat, I think going in your unit economics focus is very, very structured, right? You will not probably do like crazy discounting. And also some of it is operational, right? Like you will not ideally sort of have fancy offices.
You
like,
go in tier two cities, you
yeah,
would have
like
lower
you,
real estate.
Yeah,
the message, the entire messaging is different. as well, right?
And the fundamental expectation of how you're building the company, even my hope is even from an investor point of view,
yeah.
is to say, guys, if you are attacking this market, it's a huge one.
Right.
But let's be clear that this is not a land grab where you can eventually say, you know what, I'll extract a consumer surplus later.
Mm-hmm.
This will remain fundamentally that, where you have to be careful about unit economics from day one.
I mean, it's also a question of investor perception, right? I mean, I think like the India story is always sexier,
yeah.
right? And a lot of investors would probably superimpose the India story on the Bharat story and think that, the high flying person who's now taking like 10 flights in a month is also some tier 2, tier 3 city resident.
Yeah.
Right? It doesn't often kind of, there's no overlap between, they're mutually exclusive groups.
Yeah.
And I guess from a funding standpoint, like, you have, I mean, we kind of come from I wouldn't say a fundraising background, but we have kind of come from a banking background where
yeah.
if you actually put like a billion in someone's account, there is that urgency that, okay, let's do something big about it, right?
Fair, yeah.
Let's not go into like otherwise, like if you're a Bharat brand, you'll probably go for some sort of vernacular, localized newspaper for marketing, right?
Absolutely.
You won't actually go to a Facebook or
yeah.
to an Instagram or whatever, right? So I think there's also a question of bolt-on money for that kind of play.
Yeah.
Versus those bigger SoftBank type of tickets, which just mean that you have to go deep down into all categories.
Yeah.
And,
I mean, to be honest, which is also not a bad play, right? Like
yeah.
you become like a mass play
right.
and then eventually you carve out saying, I have a way, like if you have, let's say, 100 million user base, even if you find 5 million user base where you have an opportunity to extract a consumer surplus, right? Then you can actually build that circle wherein you actually make money in this segment.
Right.
Use that to deploy and get that 300 million, right?
Right.
But you just said that done. I think they're fundamentally very different sort of categories, how you build product approach.
I think that's still to be validated, right? Who's
yeah.
doing that?
Yeah.
I think that's what SoftBank is sort of aiming towards as well, right? Try to grab market share in as many verticals as you can.
Yeah.
Eventually bring, build enough touch points and sort of extract value there.
Yeah. And like, I mean, it will happen, right? Like, I think the other thing that you're also seeing, I think it's a global trend, but also is happening now in India across, is like, and this is a classic, you guys will know it more, right? You go through a phase where everybody consolidates, right? And then you become too consolidated and suddenly you lose identity with the consumer. And that is why you see this whole advent of D2C or direct to consumer brands that are popping
yeah.
up, right?
Yeah.
Because one, they are saying, you know what, you can get everything on an Amazon, you can get a Nike, everything on an Amazon, but suddenly you're saying, okay, you're not speaking to me, why should I buy you versus this?
Yeah.
And suddenly this advent of D2C brands where you look at like individuals getting into categories that just had for the longest time such a huge cost of getting in, right? Which is like alcohol, right? Like fundamentally you could not create an alcohol brand, but now there is this company out of US called Drinkhouse. Like they're just redefining alcohol, right? Like, and then you have there just n number of D2C brands now. There's somebody selling like shoes built out of some tier 2 factory.
Right.
And they're actually charging you more premium than, let's say, the established ones, right?
Yeah.
Because what they're saying is now the consumer is also saying, guys, I don't like Nike's gone mainstream.
Yeah.
So suddenly as a hippie millennial,
this
I'm
is
saying,
not really you.
Exclusive. Yeah. This is not cool enough for me.
Yeah.
So then I'm saying, okay, tell me a story, right?
Yeah.
And then you have this, right? So I think that circle will keep happening. You will see, again, I think the category will see, in India also, a lot of categories will see consolidation.
Right.
Right? And we'll get there and then finally unbundling starts happening again,
right?
Right? Like you saw that with Flipkart buying Myntra, then buying Chobong.
Right.
Which is pure consolidation at play.
Right.
Right? But I think like you will sort of, they will get bigger and bigger, but then they will realize that, you know what, guys, we serve the mass, but there's enough opportunity for sort of other small brands to start popping up,
right?
Which will say, okay, I will only do, let's say, gym t-shirts,
right?
And there are enough that are popping up. So I think like I'm still very sort of optimistic about this, like sort of how the ecosystem will evolve in India. But it's also, I think the only piece that is needed to be seen is at what point do we sort of start paying for convenience, right? Because I think if you look at US at least and how digital grew, right? Like there was from day one, there was a premium applied on saying if you want convenience, right? Like for example, I use an Instacart or Uber Eats or a DoorDash there.
Right.
There's inherent understanding that I'm for consumer is saying I am okay to pay for convenience, so I pay that $5 for delivery charge.
Right? Yeah.
I think the way we've built categories in India is we have said, you know what, like no delivery fee and you get a discount also, because we are so busy focusing building a category.
Yeah.
But I think what ends up happening, then suddenly you and me, we are like, okay, this is a normal. Why should I pay a delivery charge? But fundamentally, the wiring of a consumer should be, I should be able to put a premium on convenience.
Yeah.
Because fundamentally, these companies make our lives convenient. But I think the psyche has not shifted wherein saying, okay, we should pay for convenience.
Right.
Yeah. I think the psyche has gone worse now.
I expect it to be cheaper than me going out, right? Yeah. And you do the math, right? You have to get to a restaurant, right? At least like if you take an Uber or drive, there's money spent there. Then there's parking, right?
Yeah.
And like, so there's material money that you're saving, even if you pay a delivery charge. Yeah. But the other is like the time value of money, right?
Yeah.
Like you're going to get stuck half an hour in parking.
I mean, it's interesting because I think that's also linked to, I mean, like we are kind of slightly looking at a bit of macro here. It's also a question of, you know, skilling, labor costs.
Absolutely.
Right. I mean, the fact that you do have cabbies, you know, their economics is something which some aggregator would know that can be squeezed at a later stage,
yeah.
Right? Similar maybe on in the food tech space, similar
sure.
to, I mean, any other domain, right? I often feel that like for even in big cities, you know, if you look at like an Urban Clap, right, providing you with a plumber at home, those prices are also slowly going up. Right,
yeah.
I mean, it's no longer there was a time, and especially you would understand, I think all three of us will understand because we have lived overseas.
Yeah.
And we have seen how a plumber or electrician is such a novelty there, right?
Exactly.
And I mean, I recall, like, I had so many dental issues, I used to prefer to fly back to India to get them done, right?
Exactly.
But that entire equation also, I think, also slowly changing, right? And once that kicks in, then if you look at from a cost or the OPEX perspective of a platform, they will have to put in a premium for convenience then.
Yeah, and
right?
I think the only switch, and there's nothing wrong with that, right? I think you should.
Yeah.
But I think where the India story for me has become weird is because everybody is saying 300 million is what you have to go after. Right?
Yeah.
But my fundamental belief is that not everybody has to, right? Like, it's okay to have a 50 million market that pays you enough premium
yeah.
that you can actually run a sustainable sort of business, right? Like, for I love Urban Clap. But I'm just saying, the moment you tell Urban Clap to say, okay, go to like 500 cities and reduce prices, because they won't, suddenly that math starts to stop working, right? Which is, I'm okay to pay that premium and it's okay for them to maintain that experience. But imagine, because they had to go even broader, if they had to reduce their price by 100, now suddenly the experience they deliver me today starts getting impacted, right? So
right.
I think that's where I think my philosophy is that I don't think every company that is in India should try to go after 300 million, right? Which is unfortunately the story that has been sold.
Right.
But I think we are a little far away from, because the unit economics of India are not homogeneous, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, not at all, yeah.
And that's where I think a lot of companies will get into that.
We keep on seeing, right? Like you order a cab and often the guy who is actually bringing the cab, his picture and the picture on the app is different. I mean, they're sharing devices, right? There is that entire dynamic that's going behind.
You know,
that guy might be a migrant who's there just for like 2 months or 3 months just to make some extra money and goes back. And that's why probably platforms don't feel the pinch doing this.
Yeah.
Right. And but in terms of as a marketer, do you think I think we had a few marketers earlier as well, right?
Mm.
They all seem to think that Indian consumer is pretty much a mirror image of the American consumer just 20-30 years later. Do you agree with that thesis?
I mean, for the large part, yes, right? Like
right.
I think the way I define it is like the US consumer of today. I think the Indian consumer, at least till like let's say 5 years back, used to aspire to be that. Like that was always cooler, right? Like, and that is largely from a movie business, right? Like
sure.
Just seen that and adopted. But I think today in this day and age, both from a technology and also a little bit on disposable income and how the consumer of today defines that disposable income, right?
Right.
It's also, I think we're getting very, very close. I won't even put it like 20-30 years
okay.
behind.
Okay.
I would actually say, because aspiration was always there.
Right.
Now access has started coming. And then the next step for them is access is there, aspiration is there. And then it's just about saying, okay, now I behave and function like a very, very American, right? Like
right.
And it's because people are traveling more,
right?
Right? And also like access has happened, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now you could sort of order stuff that you get on like Amazon.com and like you can order stuff that is available in the US.
Yeah.
It's just purchasing power at that point, right?
I wish you could have advertising strategies which are closer there as well, which focus on like the product. or the service. And here, like, it's more like seed around the product, an emotional narrative now.
Yeah, but I mean, like, products will get better, right? Like, I think
No, advertising about those products, like the strategies that the advertising that I see generally sometimes don't even talk about the product or service that they're selling.
Yeah, which is also you'll get to that, right? Like, which is the classic sort of feature versus benefit, which is like US, because there was a certain set of understanding, and like, you didn't have to sell them the concept of food delivery, right? Like,
yeah,
they knew, they understood it on a rational, functional level, right? So you could, like, US advertising has been very, very feature-led,
right?
Wherein in India, you had to sort of hit at that emotional trigger, right? Which is saying, ki buy nahi hai, and then you get food, right? Like, you have to make that because you're trying to sort of explain to them beyond a rational
explainer style advertising.
I'm a fan of him, like, at the end of the day, right? I think there's enough science that humans don't make rational decisions, they make emotional ones,
right?
So if you think through that, and this is why you see, right, Indian advertising, for whatever it's worth, is actually sort of celebrated globally as well.
Yeah,
because we really sort of get into that. Like, everybody, you and me, all of us think that we make rational, because we are educated, we make rational choices.
Yeah.
The reality is we don't. I mean, like, 3 iPhones in the room, right? Mm. Like, if you put a feature to feature or a cost value analysis,
it won't work, right?
But there's some emotional trigger that kicks in, right? So, and that, I think, fundamentally is a big difference between US and India advertising.
Right.
But yeah, some brands get it, right? You see Nike, right? Like, when have you ever seen, like, Nike push a product in its advertising?
Yeah.
They've just gotten, like, super woke.
Athletes.
Yeah, athletics. But athletes also, like, push your dream and all that, right?
Yeah.
I think Nike, some of these brands have done the most emotional sort of type of messaging and have built brands on that.
Right? I used to think that we are a very filmy country, but you kind of are bringing rationality to that entire framework. Plus, I'm very happy that we are among the 70 million now. We have 3 iPhones here. So, anyways.
And that's also, like, as marketers, this is what we struggle with also, right? Where every time you're saying, and because Facebook and Google, and like, you just put out there, they'll figure it out.
Yeah.
But there's still value in that pure consumer research or understanding what moves the consumer, right?
Right.
Everybody just says, oh, price is the factor. But the reality of it is, yes, that is a factor, but that is not the only factor. If you get it right in terms of what problem you want, like, they want solved, or what their aspirations are, and you can speak to that, I think it just works.
Well, I mean, I think we have been now clocking around.
Which is going on.
Not bad, huh? But okay, maybe to sign off, like, you mentioned that a few people are doing it right. Like, purely from a marketing perspective, who are the companies you think who are doing it right? Be it Indian, be it overseas, doesn't matter. Like, if you have to say a few names.
Ones that you like.
Ones you can talk about, I don't know.
Yeah, I think this becomes, like, slightly challenging.
Right.
I mean, some of the smaller brands that I love, and, like, not just from an advertising perspective, right? Like, I think how Shopify is building it, right? Shopify's, I think most of the readers will know.
Right.
But I think there is marketing in that. So, for example, I'll give you a great example, right? It's a tactical one for Black Friday sale, right? They had this, their data science team actually put together a small website that just talked about every minute how many orders are happening and how many dollars are getting exchanged, which is GMV, right? Which is all their Shopify partners.
Right.
Now, technically, you will not call it marketing, right? But imagine for Shopify, their immediate customer base is people who are saying, should I sell stuff on Shopify? Now, if you imagine at one point they said 1 million orders a minute, like, that is all the marketing you need to do.
Right.
Because Shopify needs to say, I am the choice of platform for anybody who wants to sell online.
Right.
Right? So I think, like, these brands, it's like, for me, it's not even advertising, right? It's just actually, like, across the board.
Right.
It's inception.
And it's just beautifully done, right? You're communicating that message that if you look for a platform that can give you scale and reliability, I am the one, right? There's proof of the pudding there,
right?
I love the work Spotify is doing globally, but also in India. The recent Wrapped thing that they did, which is basically they went a decade back, or, like, for some people who are new to Spotify, went a year back, and they basically said, this is what you listen to, your listening time went up.
Right.
So, like, the content already existed for them, right?
Right.
But it's beautifully how they started delivering it,
right?
So, the way it got delivered was in an Instagram story format, right?
Okay.
Within Shopify app.
Right.
Now, this is a brand that is thinking right, which is saying you could have put a lot of advertising dollars, and they would have. But they said, if I organically deliver within the app an Instagram story experience, one, I get better engagement, but that's inherent social element to it, right? Because you're close to, like, music is very personal. Music is also very shareable because you want to, like, right? So there's shareability baked into that.
Right.
But they've just taken all the cognitive load out of me as a consumer to say, do I make that effort of taking a snapshot or anything? They're just saying, we will deliver it the way you want it and put it out there, right? I think so. For me, it's not that one brand that sort of cuts it across, but I think these smaller things, which is And as much as I have sort of, my portfolio has been about spending a lot of dollars.
Yes.
Right? Because in performance marketing, but I think inherently, I think that will happen, right? Performance marketing is a muscle that you, every brand should have. But I think where, for me, where brands stand out is where they understand the consumer insight. Like, for right. example, Star Wars, for the new thing, they actually did a 10-minute whole thing, immersive experience in the game Fortnite. Now imagine, yeah. like that to me is marketing, because you're talking to your consumer,
right.
because you know Fortnite folks, pseudo geeks, they will
They'll
care about, right?
Like about
it. And they're not just doing advertising. They
right.
actually work with Fortnite to actually have lightsabers as a weapon.
Right.
And that is what sort of, for me, I think the next level of marketing is, where it's just not about like building something great and deploying it.
Right.
And that's why I'm saying, right, like you didn't even know that gaming was a channel of distribution. Right?
Yeah. yeah.
And that is the beauty of it. Like Fortnite is not even two and a half years old.
Right.
And now some brand has figured out how to actually do a 10-minute spot. And it's not a spot. It's not like they didn't show their video creative, right?
Right.
They've thought it through from every angle.
Yeah.
So I think these two in the last few months really stood out, like Spotify and the Star Wars on Fortnite.
I think that's why Reed Hastings finds Fortnite as his biggest competitor.
Fortnite and sleep. That's what he's in. Sleep.
Yeah.
yeah. Eyeballs. It's all about eyeballs, right?
And it's about intentful. Like you,
yeah.
you know which audience is going there, right? Like you know Fortnite has these people who are crazy about Star Wars.
Yes.
Right? So I think you get the audience right. And then you're not doing the typical math on saying, oh, how much are your rates or whatever.
Right.
I'm sure they would have paid a bomb. But this is not your classic way of doing ROI, right? Like
yeah.
imagine I like brands now saying we'll do bolder things, which probably can't be measured. Measured conventionally, right? Like, there's no way for you, anybody to have done the math on saying, okay, what would be the ROI of this?
Right, a hunch. Right.
Yeah, but you build it as so natively.
Right.
I think for me, I think one word is like anybody who does like native like brand building, I think is a winner
right.
going forward. Right?
right.
Like you understand the platform, understand the consumer, and deliver it like that, not as an ad.
And that's also, I guess, that also is probably a subset of performance marketing in a way, or no?
I mean, I think like the fundamental thing is right, performance marketing, which market, like any marketing that does not perform is not like great. So performance
yeah. No, when you say they must have paid a bomb, I'm sure.
Yeah. So performance marketing, I think, will always be that which is the most efficient
right.
sort of in terms of immediate ROI.
Right.
But that is the way I see it, at the fast end and the slow end, right? So performance marketing is your fast end, helps you meet your quarterly numbers. And like, so it's very, very critical. It's not an either or.
Right.
But I think this is the slow end, which
right.
is this building these experiences, building like getting, talking to the community. I think those are the ones that will not bear fruit in terms of pure ROI today. But I think there is a pathway to saying, if you do keep doing enough of those, I think then you have the perfect short-term and long-term brand that's getting built.
Right.
I think that's my
thought process. I think this is, we've gone over an hour. Time has flown. I'm going to end this with one last question.
Okay.
How many apps do you have on your phone, just as a guess?
I would have almost 85, 90 apps.
You're above average.
Average
is apparently 70 apps, which came as a shock to me.
Right. Yeah, which is also, and this is also the last bit, right? Like performance marketing, like issue.
Right.
Because like the consumer of today is like ready to try anything.
Yeah.
But with 80, 90 apps, how do you fight to be that app where they actually come and open it every day, right? And that is where the long tail or the slow end that I talked about, right? Like you have to hit at me saying, oh, should I open every time I think of food?
I mean, it's no longer a matter of access. It's a matter of creating that experience with sticks.
Yeah, and it could be anything. It could just be brand marketing,
yeah.
like how you speak to me versus
right.
how you deliver the product to me or anything, right? And that is the classic struggle for a performance marketer, at least in today's world, right? You
right.
can get the app on the phone, but how do you
stick it?
Like, how do you make it retain on the phone is a bigger problem.
Solution is easy. Pay them money every time they open it. Discounting. I'm just kidding.
yeah. Hey, well, that's how we have been building it so far in the country.
Right. I think mighty interesting chat. I think we had an agenda in the beginning. We stuck to it a bit, but we
very
also went in different directions. But it was very interesting. And thanks a lot for your time, Ankit. It's been a pleasure having you here. And obviously do share the podcast in your network, goes without saying, but I'm going to put my words on the tape itself to make sure that happens.
Now you have shamed me into doing
yes,
it.
Yes. So
absolutely. It was super fun. And I know there was a lot of interesting stuff we did want to talk about. So,
it's okay.
But that's fine.
We just did that just to kind of create a framework around this. We never have one.
We could still chat without the mic.
That's absolutely.
Yeah.
No, but it was super fun. Just coming and talking. So thanks.
And thank you so much, Ankit. And again, all our listeners, do comment on this episode. Do let us know what we can do better. If you have any guest suggestions, obviously feel free to drop us a line. We have a few job postings also going on. We're looking for an SEO specialist. As per Ankit, that might not be relevant anymore, but we still are looking for one, at least in the short to medium term. And we're also looking for a full stack developer. So we'll put the job description in the podcast episode details. So yeah, do spread the word. Thank you so much, guys. And this is Nikhil Arora.
This is Charlotte Tupran.
Signing off.